session number 17620, James Watts, reel 14.
Mr. Watts, reel 14. You mentioned your own patrol experience. Were patrols a regular feature of your activities up on the hill?
Well, to do with my own company and own section, it was, there wasn't much patrol activity, but we did have fighting patrols in the battalion, you know. They were selected lads who were extremely tough, hard lads. And if, for instance, we were, like when we got relieved, they would go out and make a diversionary attack of some sort, just create a lot of disturbance, but to get the relief done so that everybody can pop in and get the instructions. But when relief finally comes, especially with poorly soldiers, who relieved us.
And they came up with the lights and so with you.
That's right, yes.
The last tape.
Well, of course, you see, they can't speak English and they're making a hell of a racket. And I mean, where we were walking about quiet, not to disturb anybody, they came in and we were only glad we couldn't get away quick enough. We left that mountain pretty fast, I'll tell you. Because we had to get off the mountain and get off the plane before daylight.
Just before we come to that, whilst we're on the question of patrolling, in your experience, were the men who were particularly good at patrolling that were obviously asked to go out time and time again because of that
skill? Yes, I think so. It was said that the colonel favoured men who were married. Men who were married looked after themselves more carefully than the more flamboyant ones who... nothing to lose, nothing to risk, you know. He thought that the married men came, the more of them came back.
Was there any other aspect of Monte Cassino which we haven't covered?
No, not really. I can't think of anything other than the fact that I was glad to get off it. And when we got back, we went to the rear, of course.
What date were you relieved?
In April. We went back. Then, of course, we went back to Caserta in that area. And we did some training, etc., and got more reinforcements because we were going to be the breakthrough division when the final assault came to attack the Gustav and the Adolf Hitler lines.
So when you were pulled back, obviously there'd be a period of cleaning yourselves up and new uniforms?
Well, you put your bivouacs up. Well, sometimes if you're lucky you would get a new uniform, but...
I didn't ask you actually whilst you were on, because how you kept yourselves clean, if you kept yourselves clean at all.
Well, I didn't shave, of course. Didn't need to, you know. I needed to shave, but I didn't come off with a beard. But the...
washing and... keeping your body clean.
No, you couldn't, that wasn't all. I mean, that was one of the features when we got back, and you got clean underwear and you could have a good shower. Because the showers, you know, could be put out in the open. They just put them in a field and you shower there, you know.
And I think you said that you didn't suffer from lice.
No. Some lads did. They found out to the cost that DDT shouldn't be liberally applied to the body.
So when you got back to your relief position, as you said,
Caserta,
did you have a period when the army let you rest?
Yes. We got, you know,
the rest was a rest.
About 4 or 5 days of rest.
What is the most important thing that a soldier coming off a situation that you had, front line situation, great deal of stress? What's the first thing that a soldier wants to do?
Sleep. Sleep in peace. Write letters home, and have a game of football.
Had you got mail while you were up on the hill?
A little bit. I think I got two letters. I think that's all I got through. There was one incident when we were in bivouac at Caserta, and we'd kick around with a football, and the ball hit an officer's tent, and he came out and said that if that ball hit his tent again, he'd put a knife in it. Well, we decided not to play football, and we went down to the village, whatever it was, and we had some wine to drink, and when I came back, I was a bit under the weather, like. Anyhow, I'd gone round with a mallet. I knocked all his tent pegs out, and the tent had fallen on, and I was trying to hit the officer with the mallet. He never found out who it was, not Kevin. And I said, I'd put a knife in your ball. No, I'd put a knife in your ball.
Do you remember who it was?
Well, the officer. No, I can't remember the officer. I can't remember a thing, actually.
Did you get much opportunity at all to meet the Italian civilians when you were in this situation?
No. Because they were scarce. You see, they just disappeared. You know, they just disappeared out the road. They probably went into cellars or something like that, but they were very poor people. The ones that I did meet, though, I liked them. I liked the peasants.
They received you quite well.
Oh, the peasant people, they're pretty good. And it's amazing what they can do with a tin of corned beef. You know, you give it. What we used to do was, would they do some washing for us? They would do some washing for us. And in return, we give them some soap, which was a, you know, perfume soap, like Lux or whatever it was, soap from America, which came through American supplies into our naffies, you know. Because that's about all I spent my wages on, me army pay on, was toilet requisites. Nothing else available that I was bothered about. We didn't get into villages or towns and cities, you know, much at all. I mean, I never saw a woman for 5 months.
Was there a toilet sheet, ration given to you each day for when you're in positions?
Well, you get a ration of soap.
Well, no, I'm thinking in terms of toilet paper, you know, for the functions. Was that issued to you each
but
day?
You see,
or,
well...
Or did you carry a supply with you?
Well, you see, we very seldom were in barracks. You see, we would build a latrine, you know.
So, say, for example, up on the hill for all those days, uh-huh. And you had your bodily functions, which we did describe, uh-huh. I didn't ask you about toilet paper.
I didn't know where I went to do it. I can't recollect, except when I threw some away in a corned beef tin. But, when it was dark, I used to go to some particular spot. Well, the compo rations, of course, included toilet paper. If you're in barracks, then
no problem there.
That's right. You see the latrine assistants. I mean, they see to everything. But other than that, I can remember one particular spot where it was about 200 yards downwind, the box, and there the lad would go and he was reading the toilet paper. And he said, somebody had taken the back pages off. He didn't know what had happened. That was Smudger Smith. I can still see him sitting there with his trousers down, sitting on that box about 200 yards away, and a shell dropped not so long, and he was taking his trousers and go running across. Yeah, it's...
What happened to you next, after you got to the rest position? And
well, I reverted. Went and saw the company commander. Told him I was reverting.
This was to private, were you saying?
Fusilier. That's right, which is the same as a private, of course. And he said, we would like you to go to the mortar platoon. We don't want to lose you, but we'd like you to go. Well, how about the mortar platoon? And, of course, that certainly made out the ground.
Were officers relatively sympathetic towards men?
Although good officers. Most of the officers. Most of the officers, I would say that 99% of the officers were good. For my battalion commanders, I didn't have any bother at all, except for one who, he was acting battalion commander, and I had no respect for him whatsoever.
Who was that?
Well, I'd rather not say. But
what was it that made you dislike him?
Well, he was a foul-mouthed man for to be an officer, and he was a complete and utter bullshitter. My battalion attacked across the Sangro, as I said earlier in an earlier tape. We had left some positions at a place called Villa Fonsina. In the attack, the colonel had been wounded down his left side. He had a tremendous scuff, because I asked him if he needed help, and he said he was receiving medical attention. When we got back to, after the 5 days we had spent, and that was a terrific battle as well, the Sangro. When we got back to Villa Fonsina, there was talk about us being put on court martials because we had left the billets in an untidy condition. These were houses which had been savaged by shells and bombs, etc., and had very little shelter to offer. But apparently when we'd left, some lads had left behind the 8th Army News or the Crusader, the Army newspapers, and they were lying about the place and it made the positions look untidy. And this was this acting colonel's orders. I'd left my billet to go and visit a pal, and on my way back, I only had my shirt on and my braces and my trousers and my shirt and boots, etc. And the next thing I knew, he's the sergeant major, regimental sergeant major, asking me to, why didn't I give the colonel a salute? Well, I didn't know the colonel.
I think we may have this already on the tape. Yeah. I think we've had this before.
Uh-huh.
But most officers, you say, were pretty good and pretty
most
understanding.
Most officers, my company commanders were very, very good.
Who was the battalion commander at Cessna?
Mackenzie. At Casino.
Casino.
He later became a brigadier. I just found out he died in 1995. He was a gentleman.
Where did you move to after your period of rest?
From Caserta, we moved back up to Mignano, where we had been about 3 months earlier. And that was going to be the starting point for us to go into the breakthrough. We did move, I think, about a half a mile or a mile farther along the 3 mile stretch from Mignano to Casino. Because, you see, the final battle was more troops, so there were more troops in Lager in the area. There was more backup, artillery and bridging and all sorts of things. Well, that was a feature, I think, which I like to bring forward. This 3 mile road to Casino also had a railway close by, and I believe that the divisions engaged in the final breakthrough used the railway line as the roadway. So when Jerry was peppering the roadway at night time, the others with all the gear was going up the bridging and the salt boats, etc., for the attack, which came off on May the 11th.
By the time you returned to that area, Casino had fallen, had it?
No.
It still was.
Oh,
still
no,
was fighting.
No, it was still there, yes. We were relieved by the Poles. The Poles were up there. We'd gone back.
And you come forward again.
And then about 3 weeks we came in.
What happened then?
Well, when we came in, the 4th Indian Division, I think, no, the 4th Division, the 4th British Division, made the assault across the river. The Poles attacked the monastery, and the French went in on our left. The positions which the French went for the Germans didn't think that was, nobody would attempt to climb the massif that was there. But they did climb it, and it was the Moroccans, I think, that won, really won the day. But after the 4th Division had made the bridgehead, we then attacked across the river, and we attacked the Gustav line and then the Adolf Hitler line. And when we finally broke through the Adolf Hitler line, we looked up at the monastery had been enshrouded in smoke all the time, you know, to keep the eyes away. And to put it in a nutshell, the Poles attacked, lost a lot of men, but a huge red and white flag went up on the monastery, and the eyes were no longer looking at us, you know, and that was over. That was, then it was next stop Rome. That, of course, was a battle in itself, that one. That was the final battle.
And what was happening to you now?
Well, although I'd been transferred to the mortars, I was designated as a runner. And one of my first tasks I had to do, the German had counterattacked, and they were counterattacking our C company. And I had to take guide 4 Sherman tanks of the Rhodesian Horse to the forward position. That was a South African armoured division. And I got in the tank and we took them over, and I could see where the fighting was and where the enemy was. I said, he said, right, oh, we're all right from here. We'll take it over from here. But I was never more glad to get out of a Sherman tank, because I think they must have attracted, it must have been made of magnets, because it seemed to be attracting anything that was flying about. So I got out, and then I had to go to the command post where the colonel was. And I got a message there, and then I had to take a message forward. And on my way back, I was blown off my feet. And whilst I was making my way back, there was a fusilier sitting down on a bit of a hill. And there was a German tank that had been knocked out. And what had happened was, I said, what's happened to you then? And one of the lads says, he's just knocked that tank out. And I said, oh, well done. And then I pushed on back to take the message. And I stayed in the command post for about a half an hour before returning to my own platoon, my mortar platoon. Whilst there, I heard the colonel and my company commander, Major Madge Delaney, they were discussing something. And I was trying not to be nosy, and shook my ears, but I couldn't help it. And years later, it dawned on me what they were talking about. They were compiling the citation for the man who had knocked the tank out, and he got the VC.
And what was his name?
Fuselier Jefferson, a relative of Stan Laurel.
Now, was he alive after this?
Oh, yes, he was alive. Yes, as I said, I'd spoken to him. And, of course, he was taken out of the line, of course, after that. You see, after he got his VC. And but he lived at Ulverston in Cumbria.
Well, what happened to your unit after this episode? Where did you go to?
Well, we're still fighting.
You're still fighting.
We're still fighting. You see, we're going through the two. We're in between the Gustav line and the Adolf Hitler line, which is further back. You know, but it wasn't a great distance. And
were you in action with the mortars?
Oh yes. No, I was used as a runner. No, I didn't have to do any mortaring.
That must have been a dangerous occupation, running.
Oh, it is. But you're on your own. You make your own decisions. If you want to get the hell out of it, you get the hell out of it. If you can see something going on, you've got to get it reported, and you know it is quite your job. But I think that suited me better than what it was stuck up on that mountain. And I remember also as I was moving past the command post, a Lieutenant Richards coming up to me and saying, what are you doing, Fuseli? I says, I'm running, sir. He says, just a minute, we want to take your photograph. And they took a photograph of me with several others, about 20 of us, holding up a German flag. I can't remember that. I could not bring that back to memory. But my daughter bought me the history of the Lancashire Fusiliers. And when I saw the photograph, she said, I thought you said you didn't have your photograph taken. You was no cameraman where you were. She said, you've got the photograph in the paper, in the book.
What happened next? What was the next stage?
Well, we won the battle. We broke through. And we got to a place called Frosinone. Whilst there, we got shelled once or twice. The German rear guard was firing back, you know, but the pursuit was on. The French had pushed further on. The Canadians came through, and then the race was on for to get as many in the bag as possible. Because the Anzio, apparently, they were to break out and cut the road from Cassino to Rome and bag the 14th German Army. But instead of breaking out and cutting the road, they turned left and went for Rome, because Mr. Mark Clark, I'll not refer to him as a general because I don't think he's worthy of the name, Mark Clark wanted to be the first man into Rome. So the...
And did you move up this road to Rome itself?
No, we went past Rome and we were after the enemy, and we pursued them, you know, and north of Rome and up to a place called Trasimena, Lake Trasimena. That was our last battle of the pursuit. But all the way along that road, there was the remnants of the German army in retreat, the 10th Army and the 14th Army in retreat. And it had been the Air Force, the Desert Air Force, had shot them up all over. And all that equipment could have been ours if the cut-off had happened. We wouldn't have had to fight the lads who had escaped to the north again in the Gothic line. But Trasimena was the end of the road for us for that phase, because we were brought back to a place called Tivoli, just outside Rome, old Roman baths. And whilst we were there, a lot of the lads who'd been in Africa and had got desert sores, etc., and never got shot of them, they bathed in those waters and they cleared up in a matter of days. And from Tivoli, which we were there about a week, we then went to Taranto and off to Egypt.
What date was this?
July. I don't know what date, you know, but it was in July.
Did you know you were going to Egypt? I mean, there's always a lot of rumours.
Well, the rumours were about that we could be going out somewhere for the refit and what have you, and it could be Egypt. So when we got to Taranto and we saw the Britannic, I think that's what they call it, a Britannic, big 30-odd thousand-tonne liner, you know, troop ship, that was it. And we're taking to Egypt.
What were you doing in Egypt?
Resting. We had a holiday, we had a fortnight in Cairo. I stopped at the Dorchester Hotel there. And we ate a lot. I remember the waiter going past with a tray full of 5 breakfasts. 5 plates. And I ate all that myself. I ate a tray full. Little Bundy's eggs, you know, and sausages and bacon and what have you. That was quite a happy place for what we were doing. We were getting re-civilized, and we were supposed to stop there for about, I I think it was 6 months. The room we had at that will probably go, we might be going to Syria or some place like that. But we were going to be reinforced, refitted, regrouped, what have you, all the various things that's necessary every now and again. We had been fighting, you know, from September, the battalion had been fighting from September right up to July with hardly a rest. And I remember holidaying, I think it was about a week on Lake Timsa. We were stationed at Beni Yusuf, which is beside the pyramids.
What did you think of the Egyptians?
Well, they weren't our friends, and rightly so. We hadn't done much for Egypt. We had taken. I think they had more respect for the Germans. But we had a particular Arab who made himself known to us and said that if we needed a guide, he'd show us round. And we utilised him to that effect, and he was a smashing bloke. He really was good. And he told us a story of, he says, your local sergeant's mess, he said. I said, oh, it's not our sergeant's mess, that's the garrison sergeant's mess. He says, every night they sing the British national anthem and they sing the Egyptian national anthem. And he said, see that man there? I said, yes, it was an Arab, another Arab. He says, he's not a very nice man. He says, he's a racketeer and this, that and the other. He does all the nasty things. He said, one night he said to me, I like the way they sing our national anthem. He said, but they've got an awful piano. I wonder if they mind if I buy them a piano, which he did. He says, I know what the English soldiers are singing, but he doesn't.
Wasn't complimentary.
No, a song about King Farouk, hanging your bollocks on a hook, and piss in the Nile in the old Egyptian style. And they used to sing this every night. And he bought them his new piano, and he said, sounds much better. He says, with the new piano. And
were you training? Did you get back to training?
Yes.
Preparation?
I remember the sergeant major saying to me, personally, you like firing the rifle, don't you? I said, yes. He says, I've got some ammunition over there. I want you to test it. He says, and if it's no good, he says, say so. So we went into the dunes, about 10 of us, and we set up targets. And I got some timbers with a bullet in, a live bullet, about 40, 50 yards away. And what I was telling them, I was instructing them to do, was to hit the bullet in the wood. You know, and I had them, they were pretty good. But when we first opened up, of course the desert, you know, stretched away for thousands of yards, maybe I don't know how many miles it stretches away. And all of a sudden, a lot of little men with white nighties on were jumping up and running over. Now these are the villains of the Arab world, waiting outside our barracks to come and raid them at night time. And they'll pinch anything. Tires off, jeeps, tents. There was one story that four Irish officers were sleeping in a big tent. And when they woke up on the morning, there was no tent. They'd undone everything and just walked away with the tent, left them asleep. We used to sleep with our rifles chained to our hands, by the way.
Yeah. How long were you there?
I don't think we're any more than... around about 7 weeks. We were supposed to be 6 months. But the Irish Brigade had got a bit upset with these people who were trying to take their eyes out, overcharging them and not playing the game. And so they did a lot of damage in Egypt. And the area commander said, well, if that's what you want to do, we'll return you back to the front. So we returned in September back to Italy.